The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Wednesday, the 11th of September, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Richard Reed, CBE, businessman, investor, entrepreneur, co-founder of Innocent Drinks, and now chairman of Agronomics, ANIC. And Richard talks about why he got involved in the modern food tech sector. Also on the podcast, Joe Solomon, managing director of Oilex, discusses the agreement they've reached with the Gujarat State Petroleum Corporation, which, upon completion, will resolve the ongoing dispute. Also, Dr. Navid Malik, executive director at the Life Sciences Division, provides an outlook on Immupharma and its flagship drug, Lupizor, a treatment for autoimmune disease lupus. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, if you get an RNS via the app, Vox Markets app, and you read the contents and you like it, you think it's a positive RNS, give it a thumbs up on the app there, and it could be featured on this podcast and also on the front page at voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Richard Reed, chairman of Agronomics. Ticker there is ANIC. Richard, thanks for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Now, I know about Agronomics, but for people not familiar with Agronomics, Richard, can you just summarise what the business is about, please?
Yeah, this business is about giving people the opportunity to get exposure to what we see as the single biggest new trend and opportunity in the way that the world eats and feeds itself, which is essentially cellular agriculture and cellular aquaculture. To put that in plain English, we're investing in the businesses that are at the front edge of finding ways to grow genuine meat in a slaughter-free way that is miles better for the environment, using essentially this technique of you get original cells and grow in bioreactors to get to a finished meat protein. And we've invested in two businesses already done it. One that's doing it in the world of pork, a company called New Age Meats, and another one that's doing it with fish proteins called Blue Malu. It's just such an exciting place to be because this is one of these rare innovations where it's a triple win. It's better for the environment, it's better for the consumer, and it's definitely better for the animals.
Yeah, do you know what? Whenever I've posted something on you guys or on, you know, this food tech, the way it's working, or clean meat, or cultured meat, there's always been people who come back who push against it, you know, and say, I'll never eat anything like that from the lab. But I think, well, hang on, if you look into how, you know, traditional protein is sourced, it's like, what? And it just makes complete sense, like you say, ethically, environmentally, health-wise as well. So your investment company, like say, people can get exposure via you to these industries. But I mean, the recent one, you see the investment in Bond Pets, for example, I don't think that created as much excitement, but that is close to revenue, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And okay, it might not grab you in the same way as being able to grow mahi-mahi or bluefin tuna like Blue Malu are going to be able to do, but the amount of animals that are reared and slaughtered to feed other animals, i.e. pets, is insane. And it's a brilliant place because actually it's a really good place to start in many ways because people that love animals tend to be pet owners. So if you can make sure that you can feed your pet the absolute biologically necessary proteins that it needs, but without having hurt any other animals in the process, it's a good sort of, again, it's another sort of double win. You know, your four-legged friend gets what he or she needs, but not at the expense of some other four-legged friends you haven't yet met. So it's just one of these things it takes a while to catch up with it. And it's a strange language to use, but the rearing of industrially farmed animals is an old and inefficient technology which brings unbelievable environmental negative consequences and humane consequences. I myself actually, I stopped eating pork about 3 years ago because I read a report where scientists had shown by doing the MRI scans of the mother pig's brain that when those piglets, after she's given birth, are instantly whipped away from her to be reared for themselves to be sold to be make pork. She said that literally what's happening in that pig's brain is the same as what would happen in a human mother's brain if the human mother's babies were taken away straight after birth. And I thought, I love bacon. I really love bacon, but I don't love it enough to have done that to another sort of living conscious animal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
New age meat is, I'm backing new age meat because I want in the future to be able to eat a pork sausage without feeling bad, and they're going to give me that opportunity. So it's just the way brands win long term, the ones that are really successful in every industry is when they don't ask their consumers to make a compromise. They don't say, well, you can have taste at the expense of health. They go, no, we're giving you something that's very tasty and very healthy. And that's what this new way of growing meat does. It means you get the meat that you love and that actually is extremely good for the body and building the proteins and all the rest of it. But it's not going to be at the expense of the environment. It's not going to be involved this unbelievable millions and millions and millions of animals being slaughtered. It's just a better way. It's the best analogy I can think of. It's the electric car replacing the internal combustion engine. You get the car that you want, the convenience of driving where you want to ever go, but in a way that doesn't have all these unintended consequences to the world at large. Mm-hmm. As opposed to up until the past, quite frankly, if you're a vegetarian and you're eating your bean burger rather than your meat burger, there was a compromise on taste. Rather than be driving a car, you're asked to ride a bike, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it's a different proposition. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is the electric vehicle equivalent, a better version of the same thing that is fit for the 21st century and the challenges that we face.
Yeah, do you know, I'm completely with you. I've literally cut back all meat eating pretty much. I eat fish, but like I said, I've said to my wife, I said, I can't wait until this new kind of meat is up and running. So I never used to go
that way. There's not going to be any wild fish. I mean, everyone knows, everyone's seen the documentary. Mm. It's not some made-up nonsense. Yeah. It's happening. It's happening within our generation. Mm. The fish that we've taken for granted and just treating as a resource that we've been exploited, it's going to end. We need to find a better way.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the beginning of that. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a massive trend, and that's why, for me personally, I don't think you can sniper shot this and think, I'm going to choose the one company that's going to win out. I think you have to build a portfolio and back the trend, and that's what Agronomics is doing. It's allowing people to get exposure to the trend rather than say, I know, I have great sort of tea leaf reading capabilities to be able to spot this one business. We're building a portfolio that goes across the different animal proteins and the different other businesses that support the whole industry to go back the trend. Get exposure to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you know, I've had people sort of argue on Twitter about its validity, and I've said, well, hang on a sec, let's look at the people who are backing this, because people like yourself, they're successful business people, we know people like Bill Gates are backing it and all that, and I think, I know who my money's on, a guy on Twitter who hasn't got even his right picture up or his name arguing with me, or billionaire investors or multimillionaire investors, but how fast do you think this is going to happen, this revolution? How long will it take, do you think, to become almost, not even sort of half mainstream, not full mainstream, where I can go along and just buy stuff in the supermarket? How long will this take, do you think?
Well, it's already happened, isn't it? It's happening. There's been a massive surge in meat-free alternatives.
Yeah.
You go to Marks and Spencer's right now, there's a £6 meal deal on a make-your-own stir-fried noodle kit where you can either have it with chicken or beef or this thing called chicken-free chicken. Now, these are sort of basically, they are reworkings of soy protein or pea protein, and, they're nutritionally, they're very good. There's nothing wrong with them. But let's face it, to eat them is not the same experience of eating some chicken. We're talking about, actually creating the same protein as the animal creates for itself without having to go by the animal and hurt them. But it's happening. I mean, the reality is it just all stacks up. But
yeah,
when you've got something, and more specifically, one of the issues with, it's not that it's the New Age meat company, they've already made the sausage. They've already done it. They've grown the pork protein. They've grown the pork fat. Tastes delicious. It is the same as eating the pork sausage that would have come from slaughtering a pig. The only issue is just that it was expensive. A year ago, it cost them $3,000 to make that sausage. 12 months later, it's cost them $300 to make that sausage. So a massive reduction in the course of 12 months, but it's still way too much to pay for a sausage. Yeah. But you just extrapolate the trend going forward. Their view is they will have those products out on the market within 3 years, selling at the same price, but with the same taste, the same sizzle, the same delicious sort of caramelized top notes as you get from that sort of pork fat as it grills in your frying pan, but without the background of it's reared and slaughtered an animal to get you there.
Yeah, yeah. So in your portfolio there, I mean, obviously you've got three sort of companies now. Is there a limit? I mean, do you have a certain number? I mean, and how do you find the... I mean, at the moment, of course, we're seeing it's a lot in the news. It's very hot. But do you have any at the moment you're looking at and you're very close to pressing the button on?
Yes. I mean, of course, but that's the day job of the business. It's to be out there meeting everyone and sorting out the sort of the contenders from the sort of the bandwagon jumpers. The portfolio will get to between 10 to 15 businesses over the foreseeable 12 to 24 months, and we think that's a good size in terms of investments for having a robust stable. But you learn more. I mean, this is the thing. My other job is I'm the co-founder of Jam Jar, which is a seed investing company. We back 50 businesses, consumer brands in the UK and Europe. The reality is, the more you do, the better you get. You get better information, you get better understanding, you get better network, and so it's. You start out with a sort of modest portfolio. We've got three at the moment. It's going to be 10 within a year or two. 5 years down the track, it'll be wider still. But what you'll also see then is the ability to double down and triple down on the ones in the portfolio that have proven to be successful. Obviously, at this super early stage, not everything we back will go the distance. It can't do. But what you have to do is you want to get in early, because then you are already around the table. You've learnt the business. You worked out how good the management team is, how likely the technology is to really work. And then you are front in line to do the Series A's and Series B's, which you do not get access to these days because they're so heavily competitive. If you think you just walk in once something's established, it doesn't work like that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The existing investors are already around the table and they will snaffle up those rights. So you need to be in at the beginning. You need to have great intel. You need to understand the tech. You need to, most importantly, understand the ability of the team to execute, which comes down to, can they harness all the technical side and create proprietary advantages which are going to be forever theirs? Secondly, do they have the ability to communicate and connect with consumers and put their proposition across? It's actually a really important part of it, because I'm not going to try and sit and say, that's an easy sell to consumers. Some people will react violently against the idea of it. Mm-hmm. So you need people with actually great sort of brand management experience as well as deep technical understanding. It's very much a supply side and a demand side business problem coming together.
Yeah. Do you know what I was just thinking there? I mean, a couple of times, of course, this sector got a lot of attention when Beyond Meat did what it did and did it 8 times its initial public offering.
Amazing.
Value. Yeah. But
absolutely incredible.
When you think of it, that's meat alternative. Now, is a good chance that one of these companies actually doing meat will do a lot better than that? Because it's actual meat. Like you said, it's a no-brainer, really. If it tastes the same, it costs the same, it's pretty better for your health as well, and environmentally it's better, then it could go beyond Beyond Meat's valuation, could it really?
We're just at the beginning of literally a new way that the world is going to feed itself. There's room for a lot, you see. I wouldn't sit and say it's got to be our way versus the other way, because they're actually compatible. They're sort of, we're brothers and sisters in arms in terms of going, can we agree a couple of things? Mm-hmm. The current system is environmentally a disaster. Mm-hmm. The current system, in terms of ethics, humane treatment of animals, is a total disaster. There are better ways. Let's get them out, let's get them funded, and let's get the consumer it's a revolution. Yeah. But it's a very lovely, peaceful one that's about tackling one of the principal causes of climate change that we can get in direct control of as consumers, and it's about improving the humaneness of how we treat animals without asking the consumer to give up on the thing that they love, which is that. And I come back to the basics. Mm-hmm. There's just something incontestably delicious about a bacon sandwich. Clearly, I'm obsessed with it because I haven't had one for 3 years. But I don't. Why take that pleasure away from someone if we can take away the the environmental and animal welfare disadvantages, because then it is, it's a win for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Long term, that really is how you make money long term. It's how you build value long term. You just make things better for the consumer. Yeah. And it is making it better for the consumer. Guilt free meat. Yes, please.
Yeah, absolutely. One final question before I ask you for the three reasons why someone should add you to their watch list. So how did you get involved with this? What was the first thing? How did you get involved with agronomics?
Well, look, I was very lucky enough to be in a situation where I set up a business with my two best friends 20 years ago. It was a company called Innocent. It makes juices and smoothies and other sort of healthy products. And we started that business from a market stall. And 15 years later, it's the biggest juice brand in Western Europe. It's employing hundreds of people, turning over this year £450 million. You know, it's, we've been involved in something that was at the front edge of pushing importance of environmental protection, about health, about taste, about nutrition, about convenience. All these things were important to consumers. We exited that in the last 5 years. As I said, we've been running Jam Jar, which is about 50 UK startups that are all in the consumer space, everything from Deliveroo, the food delivery business, through to Tails.com, which was a nutritionally specific dog food business that gives you the exact type of food for your dog, given its age and breed. And so we've been in and around what I would call sort of ethical consumerism for 20 years now, but also with a very clear sight analysis that you have to make money, you have to grow, you're not doing the world any favors if you have all these good intentions but then screw it up when it comes to the business side. So we are forever looking for altruistic, ambitious people that can make a consumer's life better and make the world a bit better in the meantime. I also know Jim Mellon, one of the key founders of Agronomics, as a friend and as a co-investor, and he asked me to get involved. And as I said, I was already doing it. You know, like all of us, I've massively reduced meat. I haven't gone meat free, but I have gone pork free because of, as I said, the ethical concerns. Mm-hmm. So it was a combination of, it's my skill set. I've been the entrepreneur. I've been the brand guy, Innocent, finding out a way to, you know, communicate and connect with consumers. And I've been the investor. So it's a dovetailing of my sort of skills and experiences and passions.
Yeah, but one thing on that, I don't want to, obviously people may be aware of Innocent, but it's a phenomenal success story. And when you first started out, and you couple of mates there were selling from a stall, could you ever foresee the potential? Did you see that kind of, did you think it was going to be quite big, but that kind of success, did you ever have that on your radar?
No, of course we didn't. I mean, our view was, well, of course it's going to fail. As most businesses do. You know, we didn't go into it with any degree of confidence. We went into it with a sort of, we just figured our life would be richer if we tried. And we were doing it as three friends, and it was something we believed in. It was all about making it easy for people to do themselves some good. But no, I mean, our business plan said that we would have a business one day turning over £6 million. And as I said, it's now the biggest juice brand in Europe. It's now this year launched in Tokyo, in Shanghai, in Russia. I mean, it's now becoming, it's on track to be the biggest juice brand in the world. Mm. And all 10% of profits going to charity, every employee being made a shareholder, all these things that we tried, all the fruit coming from ethically accredited farms. We pioneered the world's first 100% recycled plastic bottle. There's all these things that we did just to try and go, look, we absolutely want to have a business that we can be proud of financially, but also in terms of its ethics, in terms of its footprint. And do you know what? The market responded. We got employees engaged, working harder for longer. We got consumers that became massive advocates for the brand. We were up against the biggest soft drinks companies in the world. We had zero marketing expenditure, but the combination of the product, the packaging, the ethics, it connected. And so it showed me there is still a world. This is still a world where Davids that go up against Goliaths will be rewarded if they look after the consumer better, if they genuinely make things better for the community in which that consumer lives. And if you're talking products that give the same meat, but without, as I say, environmental or welfare issues, it's going to happen.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, finally, in summary, Richard, if you could, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're talking about, the progress you're making here, but are not yet following the company, give them three quick reasons in summary why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, you've got, let's face it, this is a statement of fact, it's the biggest trend in food and drink now, and it's, we're talking, it's going to be a $1 trillion industry. So this is the opportunity to get in at the beginning. Secondly, as I said, this isn't about you having to sort of double down and choose one company. This is an opportunity to play the trend by buying into a company. It's going to be backing 10 to 15 minimum in a portfolio that's ever growing. So you've got that sort of exposure, ability to play the trend. And then thirdly, this, obviously, we do it because we see there's a huge financial upside in it. And I don't want to sort of bring too much hippiness into it, but there is this thing about you can make money by doing something that's genuinely net positive for the world. And that's a great place to be, because getting rich is one thing, but getting rich in a way that's entirely net positive. That's my third factor.
Yeah, I think you probably add that the guy is doing it, involving the company like yourself there. I've had, you know, a decent track record, so I think that's worth adding. But Richard,
yeah, look, I mean, yeah. You've got Jim Mellon and his team, and they're the smartest guys in the room. So yes, it's AAA in terms of the caliber of the people doing it. Yeah,
yeah, marvelous stuff, Richard. Good to chat to you. Hopefully, we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye for now.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Joe Solomon, Managing Director of Oilex. OEX is ticker there. Joe, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Justin. Good to be talking to you again.
Yeah, some big news out yesterday, and which saw the share price shoot up, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But, Joe, as always, if someone's listening right now, brand new to the podcast, not familiar with the company, can you please summarise Oilex? What's it all about, please?
Sure. Oilex is an oil and gas exploration and production company, experts in the upstream sector, working in India and now in Australia and also in the UK with some very bright prospects.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Now, yesterday you announced major new advancement in relation to the company's Cambay project in India. Please can you outline this dispute, what it's about, and the resolution with GSPC and what it means for the company, please, Joe?
As our shareholders will well know, we've been stuck on our Indian project for some time because of a dispute relating to payment of cash calls with our Indian partner, GSPC. Mm-hmm. Our key objective has always been to get back on the ground in India and back with an active drilling program on our really highly prospective Cambay tight gas project. And we've been held up for a long, long time on this. The new agreement that we have with GSPC really puts us into a new place, and the misalignment that was there between the two companies will get resolved through this. So effectively, GSPC will be putting their 55% equity in the Cambay project up for sale. We anticipate that the sale process will run into December of this year. And on this basis, we'll be targeting to be back on the ground with a new partner, a new financially capable partner, with a drilling rig in the second or third quarter of 2020. And of course, people will realize that a key benefit of the settlement that we've agreed to here is that the costly and the time-consuming arbitration proceedings in Singapore now will not go ahead. So that's a really bright thing. We needed certain comfort and guarantees before lifting the default notice related to their non-payment. And the government of India has played a crucial and instrumental role in bringing about an acceptable resolution between the two parties. And this is really following the government's very strong policy to reduce India's dependence on energy imports. They want more production. They want more drilling. And they've been very, very helpful to us. And we'd like to thank the Ministry of Petroleum and Natural Gas and the Director General of Hydrocarbons for their proactive role in finding a settlement for us.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's move on to Australia. Recently, you've done two blocks in the Cooper Eromanga basins in Australia, and subsequently, you appointed the chairman, Mr. Brad Lingo, on a six-month consultancy, please. Can you take us through that, Joe? What's happening there?
Yeah, we've been working for some time to make further potentially value accretive acquisitions. And our focus has been in two places. It's been in the UK continental shelf and the Cooper Eromanga basins in Australia. We see a lot of potential, particularly for small cap companies in both of those areas. And in the UK, we recently appointed a new non-exec director to support our initiatives there. Mm-hmm. In Australia, we believe there's real opportunity to build a sustainable business. And we're focusing on specific and play fairways that we know about, in which we believe we can aggregate many more opportunities in the Cooper-Eromanga basins. We're really fortunate that our chairman, Mr. Brad Lingo, I mean, he's really a walking encyclopedia on the projects and the potential of the area, and having a proven track record of success from when he ran Drill Search and built it up to a very significant company between 2009 and 2015. So we've made our first acquisition. It's two blocks in the basin. We're working to make further acquisitions in the near future. And Brad's involvement ensures that we can maintain the momentum on our really well-defined strategy. And, you know, the consultancy agreement ensures that we have additional resources while, you know, maintaining maximum flexibility and focus during this period of change for the company.
Excellent stuff, Joe. And just take us through what's going to happen, milestones, hopefully news, what's happening with OilX generally over the next 12 months, if you could.
Okay. Would love to do that. Going back in history, the current exec management team was brought into the company to really fix a number of historical issues that had seen the share price of the company flag and reduced shareholder value. With this resolution of the Cambay project that we spoke about in the first question, we're effectively clearing the last hurdle in the 5-point plan that we made back in 2016. And our focus now is fully directed to delivering value from the growing asset portfolio that we're building. So number one is the commercialization of the large gas resource at Cambay. Mm-hmm. And our shareholders well know that this represents substantial potential unrealized value. Our commitment is to get progress on Cambay as soon as it's practicable. Our plan for a work program at Cambay is well advanced. We're looking to drill two vertical wells and test those for gas flows. Our priority is the drilling and stimulation recommendations, implementing those that were provided to us from a 2017 study by Baker Hughes, GE, and which we've been stopped from doing because of the dispute with GSPC. Mm-hmm. Any early production that we get from those wells, we'll look to use our existing process and storage facilities. We'll upgrade them as required. And by doing that, we'll have a low-cost path to commercialization. Mm-hmm. Given success, then we go into a larger drilling program, and our aim is to aggregate enough production volumes to connect to the high-pressure pipelines in India, which offer greater offtake and higher gas prices. The second thing, we're looking to build a sustainable E&P business in the Cooper Basin. This strategy that we're following is well advanced. It's very focused. We have a lot of experience in the basin. It's taken 2 years of foundation development, and we're now poised to push the go fast button.
Excellent.
And
yep.
just finishing rounding that off, you know, with the resolution of the GSPC dispute, it's also an opportunity to reinvigorate looking for new ventures in India. We've got an outstanding team in India, and they played a pivotal role in getting the settlement with GSPC over the line. So we've shown that we can work in India and do business there. It can be difficult and challenging, but we've got over what we think is probably some of the most difficult issues that you could face in India.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? I was going to ask you for three reasons why someone's hit the follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, but I think you covered that off there. And, Joe, plenty there. I mean, if there's any points you want to add, feel free, but I think you did a good job there, didn't you?
I could. Look, all I'd like to say is that we've taken the time when we've been held up in India to set foundations for new business and for going ahead. We've identified places with enormous potential. We're working away there. We've got the Brad Lingo advantage in the Cooper-Eromanga basins. And just like to finish to say, as always, we're committed to return value to our shareholders. And we've got three areas that we're working in rather than the one traditional one. So hopefully we're on the turn and looking for bigger and better things in the future.
Marvellous stuff, Joe. Good to chat to you. Like I said, lots of things going on, so hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Navid Malik, Head of Life Sciences Research at the Life Sciences Division. Dr. Navid, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks, Justin.
Now, first and foremost, give a background, if you could. I'll sort of to give the acronym or the initials a lot easier, TLSD, the Life Sciences Division. So give us a bit of background as to what that's all about, your company, and also, on the back of that, your interest in Immupharma, which you're talking about today.
Yes, thanks so much. So basically, the Life Sciences Division is a FCA-regulated investment bank. Mm-hmm. It started about 3 years ago. We've been doing a number of deals in the sector, raising money for companies as financial advisor or broker. And we actually actively cover a number of companies from an equity research perspective as well. So we've been looking at the sector primarily in terms of value. We're looking for companies which have a disruptive technology or technology that can change a paradigm in disease. And we're looking at both private and public companies. So we work between the two areas of the market.
I see.
My interest in Immupharma is really historical. A number of firms back where I worked as an equity analyst building a life sciences franchise, I first met Dimitrio and the team back in, I think it was 2010. And I actually thought at that time that what they were doing was quite innovative and very needed in terms of the technology and what it could do in lupus. I knew the disease itself had a high unmet medical need. And I basically was intrigued by the deal they had completed, which was with a company called Cephalon. So since that time, I've basically actively covered the company as a house analyst in various firms. And now I'm covering the company because basically we see a lot of value inflection points looming for the business. And we think that the technology and the platform they're developing has a lot of intrinsic value. And in this market, it's very important, I think, to focus on those type of companies.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you've published a new research note on Immupharma and its lead drug, Lupizor. And this is it follows a sort of detailed initiation note you published back in May. So can you give us a summary of this new note, please?
Yes, so the note is basically talking to what was announced by a pharmaceutical company called AstraZeneca. So we've written an update research note, which is effectively positioning our view of what Lupizor for Immupharma, its particular perspective in relation to the update AstraZeneca gave several days ago. So AstraZeneca had a phase three clinical trial in lupus. It was the second of two phase threes, first of which had failed a year ago. The second was successful. And that, I think, has garnered a bit of interest in the market. We have appreciated the fact that, you know, more pharma companies are going to be coming into the space because we could see a way forward now for companies to deliver drugs in this area, which has been notoriously difficult to be successful in. Immupharma's investment thesis for me has improved more than it was before. And simply that's the case because I believe that now there'll be more investor attention and more industry attention to the lupus space. This phase three trial that AstraZeneca has successfully hit the mark with wasn't expected, but it does give us a very strong endorsement, I feel, for ploughing forward in the lupus area. And Lupizor, as we said in our initiation note and reiterated in our update note as of yesterday, Lupizor has a very clear path to market for us. And we believe that a partnering deal or other mechanisms to fund a second phase three would actually generate a lot of value for investors.
I see. And what are the sort of key points that you feel are, you know, are important in the longer-term potential of Immupharma's Lupizor drug and its, you know, positioning within the lupus landscape?
So the lupus space has had so many different pharma companies attacking it in terms of developing drugs to different pathways or different targets. A lot of those pathways and targets have not really been proven in any to any degree. The only one drug that was successful was the one that GlaxoSmithKline developed with a biotech company in the US called Benlysta. It doesn't work very well and there are safety concerns around it. Lupizor has an eloquent mechanism of action, and despite all the noise that we've seen in lupus field with a number of trial failures, the fact that Lupizor has a mechanism of action which is aligned with the patient seeing very low side effect issues, as in non-existent side effects, compared to nice efficacy and the mechanism of action showing the drug could work to alter the fate of the disease in a positive manner for the patient, gives us the opportunity to see the potential for Lupron being significant if they can get through a second phase three. And the question then becomes, you know, can they negotiate a second phase three successfully? Well, we believe that with a particular biomarker that's prevalent in lupus patients, which Lupron eloquently works with to help the patient, the combination of the two could create a real successful formula for Lupron to successfully navigate second phase three and get to market, which would build a phenomenal amount of value both for ImmuPharma and also provide a real alternative for patients who up until now have very little in terms of treatment options.
I see. And do you think right now, you know, it's your view that we sort of may be at a turning point in bringing sort of further lupus drugs to the market now?
Absolutely. And the analogy I would use in an area I've looked at for a long time is the immune therapy space in cancer. Mm-hmm. These immune therapies came from a backdrop where a number of trials 10 or 15 years ago had been conducted in the immune therapy area in cancer. All had failed. Everyone had written off the field. And then these new technologies called checkpoint inhibitors emerged. And Bristol Myers Squibb was the company that brought the first one to market, a drug called Yervoy in melanoma, 5 years or so ago. That was an inflection point. That showed everyone that the biology behind why you would use immune therapies to tackle cancer actually could work, would work, and that's become the biggest growth driver of cancer today. In lupus, the same story, the same path, the same approach is very valid here right now. Everyone's written off the lupus field because we haven't had, you know, consistently positive clinical data in different clinical trials. Mm-hmm. We're now seeing evidence to suggest that there are ways forward, and AstraZeneca has delivered a positive phase three trial several days ago to prove that. Astra's positioning in the market is still not clear because we don't know what the data is in that trial. It hasn't been disclosed. We also don't know whether the target they used, the mechanism of measuring benefits in lupus patients, will be accepted by regulators. But Lupron and ImmuPharma don't have those issues. The mechanism of action works. The subgroup in Europe, the Lupron original trial that read out last year, proves that, and it works really well, and it's a safe drug, as evidence from the clinical trial and the open-label study.
Yeah, so that is very interesting that you say that, because I mean, you know, those parallels with, you know, like cancer, isn't it? Because I mean, years of failure there, and then
yes,
now,
yes,
you know,
exactly. Okay. Yeah, and it's very exciting because we're talking about the immune therapy space in cancer. There are no drugs that were approved that worked. And they went for the toughest one, melanoma, malignant melanoma, and it was a home run. You know, patients who responded on Yervoy, the checkpoint inhibitor drug, weren't just living. They were living for 10 years in a disease where you die within a year or so. So for the analogies I'm making with lupus as a field, you know, I don't like to use the word, but it is a graveyard. You know, we've had so many companies trying to look at a field where there are about 5 million patients, if you look at all the various connotations of how the disease manifests itself. There's about 5 million patients who could be ascribed as sufferers of lupus worldwide. Mm-hmm. And yet only one drug in 60 years has made it. So why should that not be an opportunity for a drug that could work and that is safe and that only has one phase three trial, as in with lupus or between it and a successful entry into the market? And that's the opportunity, I think, the parallel with the immune therapy in cancer. That's what lupus gives us. And lupus, or I feel strongly, has the opportunity to navigate those choppy waters.
Okay, last question. Considering now we are with ImmuPharma just below 10 pence, what are the key milestones you'd now expect ImmuPharma to achieve over the next period or so to reach your target price, which is 76 pence?
So our target price is based on a discounted cash flow model, which we've generated on Lupron only. We haven't valued other components in the business. However, we do appreciate that other elements of the business do have value. So we know that Nucynt has value. We know that the peptide technology that ImmuPharma has value as well. However, on Lupron, we believe that if Lupron was able to enter into a phase three, through a partnership or through a mechanism to fund that phase three trial, that would be a major inflection point. Because if you retrace back where the shares have come from, the share price has come from, it's very easy to see that share price retrack upwards again. More importantly than that, we now have, I think, a de-risked approach to a successful phase three for ImmuPharma. So if we can get through a couple of those inflection points, I think the share price could appreciate significantly in the short term in the next 12 months.
Excellent stuff. Dr. Navid, thanks very much for coming on. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you, Justin.
OK, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, United Oil & Gas, UKOG, up 2%. At four, it's Polarion, POLX, down 7.3% to 19 pence. At three, Zenanga Iron Ore Company, down 9.2% to 11.1 pence. At two, it's i3 Energy, down 3.2% to 29.5 pence. And number one most followed company is Zoe, Zoetic, good ticker. Zoetic International, of course, changed the name from Highlands Natural Resources, because now focusing on CBD. And like I said, Zoe is ticker. It's very memorable, that. Okay, top five most liked RNSs come from the following companies. At five, Anglo African Oil and Gas, commencement of well re-entry operations. At four, it is UKOG, United Oil and Gas, completion of acquisition in Horse Hill. At three, Cora Gold, further gold mineralization confirmed at Zone B. At two, mineral resource update nearing completion. Who's that? It's ACP, Armadale Capital. Put your company's name at the front of the RNS, please. Makes my job a lot easier, and that's the main thing. It's the most important thing. Most important point. And number one, most liked RNS came from Integumin, ticker is skin, of course. That's the interim results. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.